Before dawn on the third morning, the caliph's barge conveyed the guests to the palace wharf, where Mansur was waiting with a large bodyguard of armed horsemen and grooms to greet them. After another lengthy exchange of compliments, he led Sir Guy to an Arab stallion with a glistening sable coat. Then the grooms led forward a chestnut mare for Verity. She seemed a tractable animal, although she had the legs and deep chest that bespoke both speed and stamina. Verity mounted astride with the ease and grace of an accomplished horsewoman. When they moved out through the city gates, it was still dark, and outriders went ahead with torches to light the road. Mansur rode in close attendance on Sir Guy, elegant in his English hunting dress, Verity at her father's left hand. She wore an intriguing mixture of English and Oriental hunting dress. Her high silk hat was held in place by a long blue scarf, the loose ends thrown back over one shoulder. Her blue coat reached below her knees, but the tails were pleated to allow her freedom of movement while preserving her modesty. Beneath it she had on loose cotton trousers and soft knee boots. Mansur had chosen for her a jewelled saddle with high pommel and cantle. At the jetty she had greeted him frostily and barely glanced at him while she chatted easily with her father. Excluded from her conversation, Mansur was able to study her quite openly. She was one of those unusual Englishwomen who flourish in the tropics. Rather than wilting and sweating and succumbing to the prickly heat, she was cool and poised. Even her costume, which might have been dowdy or outrageous on another, she wore with elan. At first they rode through the date palm groves and cultivated fields outside the city walls, where in the first light of dawn veiled women drew water from deep wells and carried it away in pots balanced on their heads. Herds of camels and beautiful horses drank together from the irrigation canals. On the fringe of the desert they came upon encampments of tribesmen who had come in from the wilderness in response to the caliph's summons to arms. They came out of their tents and shouted loyal greetings to the prince and fired joy shots in the air as he passed. But soon they were out in the true desert. When the day broke over the dunes, they were all awed by its majesty. The fine dust clouds suspended in the air reflected the sun's rays and set the eastern sky on fire. Although Verity rode with her head thrown back to gaze upon the celestial splendour, she was acutely aware that the prince was watching her. His importunity no longer annoyed her so intensely. Despite herself, she was beginning to find his attention amusing, although she was determined not to give him the slightest encouragement. Ahead of them, a large group of riders came over the dunes to meet them. The huntsmen led them. Their horses were gaily caparisoned in the gold and blue colours of the caliphate, and they carried hooded falcons on their wrists. Behind them came the musicians with lutes, horns, and the big bass drums suspended on each side of their saddles, then a rabble of grooms leading spare horses, water carriers, and other retainers. They welcomed the consul general with shouting and musket shots, fanfares, and the booming beat of the drums, then fell in behind the prince's party. After several hours riding, Mansur led them across a wide, arid plain to where a steep valley fell away to a dry riverbed far below. On the top of these cliffs stood a weird cluster of massive rock monoliths. As they drew closer, Verity realized that they were the remains of an ancient city that was perched above the valley, guarding a long-forgotten trade route. "What ruins are these?" Verity asked Mansur, the first words she had spoken directly to him all that morning. "We call it Isakandarabad, the city of Alexander. The Macedonian passed this way 3,000 years ago. His army built this fortress." They rode in among the tumbled walls and monuments, where once mighty armies had celebrated their triumphs. Now they were inhabited only by the lizard and the scorpion. However, a flock of servants had arrived during the preceding days, and in the courtyard, where perhaps the conqueror had once held sway, they had set up the hunting camp, 100 coloured pavilions furnished with all the luxuries and amenities of a royal palace. There were servants to meet the guests, too. Perfumed water was poured for them from golden ewers so that they might wash away the dust of their ride and refresh themselves. Then Mansur led them to the largest of the grand tents. When they entered, Verity saw it was hung with draperies of gold and blue silk, and that the floors were covered with precious rugs and cushions. The caliph and his counsellors rose to greet them. Verity's skills as an interpreter were tested by the exchanges of compliments and good wishes. Nevertheless, she took the opportunity to study the caliph, Al-Salil. Like his son, he was red-bearded and handsome. Yet there were the marks of care and sorrow etched deeply into his features, and silver threads in his beard, which he had not covered with henna dye. There was something else she found impossible to fathom. She felt a sense of déjà vu when she looked into his eyes. Was it simply that Prince Mansur so closely resembled him? She thought not. It was more than that. Added to this disconcerting impression, something strange was taking place between her father and Al-Salil also. They stared at each other as though they were not strangers meeting for the first time. There was a brittle tension between them. It was as though the summer thunderstorms were brewing and the air was heavy with humidity and the sense that the lightning would flash out at any moment. Al-Salil led her father to the centre of the tent and seated him on a pile of cushions. He took the place beside him. Servants brought them aniseed-flavoured sherbet in golden goblets, and they nibbled at sugared dates and pomegranates. The silk draperies kept out the worst of the desert heat, and the conversation was polite. The royal cooks served the midday meal. Dorian helped Sir Guy to titbits from huge salvers which overflowed with saffron rice, tender lamb and baked fish, then waved away what remained to be taken to his retinue seated in ranks outside the pavilion. Now the talk became more earnest. Sir Guy nodded at Verity to come to sit between him and Al-Salil. Then, while the sun rose to its zenith and outside all the world drowsed in the heat, they conversed in low tones. Sir Guy warned Al-Salil of how fragile was the alliance of desert tribes that he was building. Zayn al-Din has enlisted the support of the Sublime Porte in Constantinople. Already there are 20,000 Turkish troops in Zanzibar, and the ships to convey them to these shores as soon as the monsoon turns. What of the English company? Will they side with Zayn? Al-Salil asked. They have not yet committed themselves, Sir Guy replied. As you are probably aware, the governor in Bombay awaits my recommendation before he decides. He might just as well have used the word order rather than recommendation. Al-Salil and every one of his council could be in no doubt as to where the power lay. Verity was so absorbed with her work of translating that again Mansur could study her intimately. For the first time he became aware of strange depths and undercurrents between her and her father. Could it be that she was afraid of him, he wondered? He could not be certain, but he sensed something dark and chilling to the spirit.